Okay, so let's go ahead and begin. So it's, I'm actually going to give you an introduction, Jim.
Oh.
So Jim Liebert is here as the Observer of the Week, and I hope all of you have taken full advantage of his expertise. Jim shares many things in common with the program that might not be obvious. He, like many of us, works only on degenerate objects. Most, right now, brown dwarfs, which is something he's not going to talk about. But he's done work ranging from white dwarfs to, and right now, most recently, a lot of work on brown dwarfs. And hopefully will tell us what we should expect, what we should all have already known about spin and magnetism and isolated white dwarfs, the brethren to the neutron stars that we haven't been talking about nearly enough. Jim.
Thanks, Lars. I've certainly enjoyed this week here. It's been stimulating, and it's gotten me away from the usual hassles of one's home base for a week out of the semester. I want to start by giving a bit of a preview. Well, I'm going to give a bit of an introduction to white dwarfs in general and a plug to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey project, which is hardly thought of as a project to discover new white dwarfs, but it's doing just that in the course of the higher priority science, such as looking for high redshift QSOs here. The QSOs cut across this kind of slice in three color space. This is, you know, the usual Sloan colors, U minus G, R minus I, G minus R. The different colors correspond to different objects. The QSOs sprinkle all the way across through here and invade the territory of the hot stars, which are mostly white dwarfs. And the white dwarfs fold into the general stellar locus when they become cool. And that makes them hard to find. And thank you. Unless they are white dwarfs with unusual colors. And here's the same cube projected in on the sides, and you can see that the power of the Sloan colors to distinguish things by different combinations of the plot. I don't want to talk about this very long, but let me just illustrate the point. If you have, there have already been three magnetic white dwarfs discovered in Sloan data. Here are the nice Zeeman triplets of a DA hydrogen atmosphere and a DB helium atmosphere that Bred defined the spectral types the other day. Those are not unusual in color, however, because the fields are low. You can get very strange blanketing, as we call it in stellar atmospheres, if you have a strong magnetic field combined with strong features. This is a normal cool white dwarf, weak and strong carbon molecular opacity. These are C2 Swan bands, molecular or diatomic carbon in the optical part of the spectrum, indicated in angstroms here. This is some kind of carbon features in a field of 100 megagauss or greater, just to illustrate. Now, you can see what this is going to do to the Sloan color. The Sloan G is centered about here, the Sloan R up here. So G minus R is going to be very red, R minus I, not so red, and so on. So it's going to easily stand out in this kind of multicolor space that Sloan works with. I want to say a few general things about the mass distribution and other parameters of white dwarfs in order to be able to put the magnetic white dwarfs into the right context. Now, in the 90s, I did a lot of work with Pierre Bergeron, in which we took spectra and Pierre fit them to determine most directly the temperature of the gravity. These are all DAs with just hydrogen showing in the spectrum, just the Bollmer lines. And you can think of the Bollmer lines due to the very strong Stark broadening. They're sensitive to temperature through the hydrogen line strengths do vary with temperature, reaching a peak at about 15 to 20,000 degrees and falling off in strength on either side of that temperature range. But the high Bollmer lines are most sensitive to the Stark broadening, the upper levels of hydrogen, and level 2 of hydrogen as the bottom state. And so you can think of the strengths of the Hybome lines as being sensitive to gravity. So this star over here, which has a high mass and gravity, you barely see any Hybome lines. Conversely, stars with a low gravity, this one down here, have very sharp Bomer lines as well as well-defined Bomer lines from the high states. So this is I think it's even better than astrometric masses normally are, to get the mass of the star in this way by using an evolutionary model as a second relationship between mass and radius, the gravity being the first, if you will. So then you solve for mass and radius. Here's a massive white dwarf in the Pleiades cluster, 0.95 solar mass, presumably coming from the single star evolution of something greater than about six solar masses as the progenitor, being the only known star in the Pleiades cluster that is post-main sequence, that has finished, the only visible star anyway.
You mentioned an evolution model. How much difference can the age make in the mass determination? I mean, if you change the age by a factor of two, for example, how much would that change in?
Change the age?
It doesn't matter, I would assume, but...
You have the effective temperature and the mass, so the evolutionary model tells you the age, and it can be uncertain, Brad, maybe 20-30% easily, depending on the physics put in.
If you had a distance, right, you could use effective temperature and log G and just eliminate to get the...
That's right. You have alternatives. You can measure gravitational redshifts for this one in the Pleiades, because the cluster velocity is known, and the gravitational redshift gives a mass of about one within several hundredths of this value. You can use the parallax, especially for clusters you have all the stars at the same distance. Even if your parallax is uncertain, you get good relative masses out of that. So you have various checks on this particular way of doing it. But for the most part, hot white dwarfs like these do not have really accurate distances because of the size of the parallax in milliarc seconds. They're fairly far away compared to cool white dwarfs. Okay? I'm not sure whether I answered your question.
If you measure G and you know the composition, then for a degenerate star, you would immediately have M.
The composition is assumed to be carbon-oxygen for masses above 5/10, say.
So are you getting M from G?
So you're getting M from G. G is M over R squared. The evolutionary model tells you R is a function of M and T, where T is...
The question I have is how much does the non-degeneracy, what sort of error does that introduce into M?
Yeah, you have to take into account the shrinkage of the radius from a very hot star, especially a low-mass hot star, as it gives up its thermal energy.
I guess one theory answer would be that for the most massive guys, it's less of a problem. Once you get down to the less massive guys,
But there are problems because you don't know the final outer layer masses of hydrogen and helium. You have to assume something from stellar evolution there. And that makes a difference on the final radius as well. In particular, the outer layer mass of hydrogen. Now I'm going to show you some mass distributions for samples of white dwarfs mostly from the Palomar Green Survey in dark symbols anyway. And I'm plotting it not just as a mass distribution per se, but rather as an HR diagram where the ridge lines of mass are drawn in. And you can see the expected peak at 6/10, especially for the dark PG stars that are from a color and magnitude limited survey with no biases as to selection that we would hope, except for the radius of the star, which is a bias we'll get to in a minute. Now the lines that go across this way are...
When you said the expected peak at 6/10, why is it expected?
Well, it's been expected since about 1979 when Volker Weidemann and Detlef Kester first did similar analyses using just colors, and they discovered, somewhat to people's surprise, Harry Shipman also at the same time, that the mean mass of white dwarfs, single white dwarfs in the field, was well below a solar mass. And so we've known about the peak being at 6/10 for 20-some years. We haven't had as refined, I would say, as refined a mass distribution, and we haven't known as much about outliers because samples have been smaller, and therefore oddballs have not yet been found. These are roughly cooling isochrones using Matt Wood carbon-oxygen models, so they're really not the appropriate model here at 4/10 where the core is almost certainly composed of helium. But the point I want to make before we talk about the open circles here is from just the filled circles from this color magnitude limited survey, you see a well-defined peak plotted this way at 6/10, the distribution about it, but you also see outliers. This low mass group looks like almost a separate distribution, and I would argue that they are. And then there are high mass stars, including three magnetic white dwarfs plotted as asterisks down here. Moreover, if you select your white dwarfs on the basis of, say, EUV radiation or soft X-rays, this is the distribution of Rosat DAs, you preferentially get white dwarfs that have low opacity at these short wavelengths. And when you're well below 912 angstroms, if you have a pure hydrogen atmosphere because of gravitational diffusion, which is pure at log G of 9 at high mass than at this peak mass or lower masses, then you're going to selectively get both hot stars, because they emit more soft X-ray radiation, and massive stars despite their smaller radii. And that is why the Rosat distribution, which lacks both cool stars and this low mass distribution, are different looking than the optical color magnitude limited survey gave. But you have to correct, let's go back to a subset of that optical survey, the PG survey, which also was a survey to look for bright quasars, found a lot of white dwarfs. And this is the mass distribution just in one dimension. You see relatively few of the massive stars. You see the hump of low mass stars. Converted to mass from gravity and correcting for the search volume by the radius, you get the green distribution. Now this is small sample statistics, but it gives more than a hint that because this is a magnitude limited survey, you substantially underestimate the number of stars that possibly exist in a space density in a constant volume around the sun of high mass. And I argue that both the low mass white dwarfs, which are now they're overrepresented here in the survey because they have large radii and can be seen to greater distances out to the same magnitude limit. These are less important, but they are still there. The massive ones can be more important. So there are basically three mass components to the white dwarf population of the solar neighborhood. We're talking about the disk in the vicinity of the sun within typically a few hundred parsecs or less of the sun. There is the normal peak from single star evolution coming from 1.5 solar mass progenitors on average. There are the massive stars for which, if they exist in overabundance compared to what you would predict from the initial mass, final mass relation, and some kind of constant assumption of constant star formation rate and Saltpeter-like mass function, there shouldn't be very many of these. There should be the one in the Pleiades, but there aren't many expected like that in the field. So, several people have argued recently, and I concur, that this is evidence that mergers probably of ordinary white dwarfs in close binaries produce a more massive single white dwarf as the result. And likewise, it's now known that this population down here of low mass white dwarfs, the ones that I allege have helium cores because they're too low in mass to have ignited helium in their evolution, they must have been stripped by a companion, which is probably going to still be there. And in fact, this hypothesis has been shown to be the case, as Tom Marsh and collaborators have found many of these. They've selectively looked at them with a the William Herschel telescope with a high-resolution spectrograph and found periodic radial velocity.
Why do the two peaks represent compositional difference, say CO versus oxygen neon?
These could be oxygen neon. These are certainly CO, and these helium. That's another way of saying it. But you need binary evolution to get both this and this group, at least the preponderance of this group. Although I really rely on the EUV surveys. They've found many more of these. As I say, this is only three stars.
Are those three stars single?
No. Well, I don't have a strong conclusion to that. There's no evidence that they are binary. The idea that I expressed a minute ago would be that they had formerly been a binary white dwarf, so that would predict they would now be single and perhaps rapidly rotating. The lines are so broad, you saw the example I showed at the beginning, so broad that you can't say, you can hardly say anything about limiting the rotation, except that they're not breaking up. Okay,
so
that's...
Just one question. The low mass guys, those log Gs are... Maybe absolutely certain by low mass, not just a position of 2 in the binary, 2.6 total mass guys with
over-luminous. Well, the line spectrum tells you that they have a very high surface gravity. Okay. So if you added 2.6s together, you'd get something twice as bright, but it would have the normal widths of the spectral lines. So again, The few magnetic white dwarfs in this sample are over here, but it's only three stars. And I don't mean to say that all massive stars are magnetic. Well, let's talk about, I'll put up one equation. I'm not going to discuss a lot of theory in front of theorists, but these are the Hamiltonian in the presence of a magnetic field has these two additional terms, and I haven't written down a spin orbit or a nuclear term, but you all know this stuff, just projecting the orbital L into the Z direction where theta is defined to be zero. Here are the linear and quadratic terms proportional to the first power of the magnetic field and the second power, respectively, if a magnetic field is present. And so I just want to show the result of the magnetic field being present in terms of predicted splitting, breakdown of the hydrogen degeneracy of the, say, the H beta line, 2-4 transition. Here's the delta M splitting, and then the L's split off, and you get multiple components out of what was H beta at one particular wavelength in the absence of a field. Here, of course, fields up to several million Gauss, and I'm going to consistently use megagauss as the unit of magnetic field because that's appropriate for observed white dwarfs anyway. And then you can see the quadratic effect becoming more and more important as you approach 10 megagauss and dominant beyond that. And so the simple triplet splitting is no longer what you see, but it depends very much on which level of hydrogen, for example, we're talking about. And when you get to really high fields, these are predictions of Wunner and his group in Germany. Okay, now the units of magnetic field are this beta, which has the feature that a beta of 1 here is about where the Coulomb and magnetic terms of the Hamiltonian trade places in importance. And on the left-hand side, the magnetic is much less important than the Coulomb. On the right, the opposite is true. And the modes just go crazy. The breakdown of the validity of quantum numbers in the designation occurs, and eventually the electrons are going to want to oscillate around Larmor levels and forget about the atom altogether. So we'll see evidence of this in action, and I'm going to primarily show examples the rest of the way to illustrate the trends and the observations of magnetic white dwarfs and what we can conclude about the field and its relationship to rotation and other things. But let's start at the low end. And this is one of the two or three lowest fields yet measured in a white dwarf. And again, I didn't say this at the beginning, that about 4% of all catalog white dwarfs are known to be magnetic, that's a lower limit to the total true fraction, but not vastly a lower limit. I mean, I would be surprised if the true fraction defined as having fields above 10 to the fifth Gauss, that's above this value, I'd be surprised if the true fraction exceeded 10% of the total, but the other 90% could be below 10 to the fifth Gauss. Although, I mean, surveys like this require both resolution and good signal to noise have not been made for all of the known white dwarfs by any means. Very few people are doing this kind of thing. One of them is my colleague Gary Schmidt at the University of Arizona, who's now adding two observational database in the southern hemisphere in a visit to the Mount Stromlo Observatory. And this illustrates what you can do to go below 100 kilogauss as a working test. This star, if you just looked at its Balmer lines in intensity spectra, Bergeron would probably find that these don't fit exactly right, but it would be difficult to conclude that such a star is magnetic without having spectropolarimetry, where you see the circular dichroism of the line, and it's rather easily detected for H beta, and the signal to noise at H alpha is beginning to be bad enough that you would question the detection. But you can also repeat the observations a few nights in a row and see whether there's evidence of periodic variability. If the star is rotating, you may you have always the working assumption is it's a dipolar field, and with a inclined dipole, you can have one pole pointing towards you, and the one of the opposite sign may show up the following night, and then this dichroism would be reversed, and you can get a period for the rotation that way, which Gary has succeeded in doing for several of these stars anyway, that he discovered this way out of the large sample that he observed. As you go higher than 100,000 Gauss into the tenths of megagauss, this is actually up to just past 1 megagauss, then you start to see the triplet splittings, the cores being resolved just in intensity spectra. These happen to be a couple of fairly hot ones. This is relatively massive, about 8 or 9 tenths of a solar mass. This one is 1.2 solar mass in the FITS. You have to have a leap of faith about your understanding of broadening theory. There's really the assumption that the normal Stark broadening behaves for each component as a separate line. Therefore, there's the reliability of this fit, this is the bottom of the two stars I just showed, has got to be less certain than the case of no magnetic field. But from the low order, the lowest Balmer lines, you can try to get an estimate. At least it's robust enough to conclude that the star is fairly massive. As you pass 10 to the 7th Gauss, 10 megagauss, you get to the point where circular polarization occurs in the continuum. This was the original way that Kemp discovered the first magnetic white dwarf, Greenwich plus 70, 8247. I'll show you in a little while. But that's a much higher field than 10 to the 7th Gauss. But this is what you measure for a periodic rotating star where both poles are it's an almost equator-on view of an offset dipole, and there's only a small offset of the dipole itself from the center of the star in this case. Hence, you see a nearly equal, not quite equal, and opposite amplitudes of positive and negative circular polarization. So it's a very nice case, yes.
Sorry to interrupt you, I didn't quite catch, is the circular polarization intrinsic to the emission mechanism, or is it a transfer effect through the magnetic field?
It's an opacity effect that opacity. The extraordinary and ordinary rays
have different refractivities.
Right, but it's only important at an order, two orders of magnitude higher than where I started with the dichroism in the line. And it's only circular polarization, and that's predicted. Neutron stars show nothing but linear polarization, isn't that right? And white dwarfs are mostly circular until we get to really high fields, as I'll get to. And that's what is expected.
In the radio, it's really pulsars do show some linear, some circular.
Yeah. But the star phase 7 is interesting in that we modeled this in detail with this. This is from a paper that I'm a co-author of in the, I wanted to show the review in the August PASP, which I have, I failed to bring down with me. I just brought the August PASP, the publications of the ASP is a small journal, monthly, and so you can carry the, instead of carrying a reprint, which I haven't been sent, I just carry the journal. And this comes from that very old-fashioned, but it very. But what I want to point out here is how sharp, I mean, these are the observed spectra of components of both hydrogen and helium. This is a star that has a mixed atmosphere. It would be called by spectroscopists a DBA. And it has mostly helium atmosphere with strong traces of hydrogen, which vary in composition along the surface, like a peculiar A-type star, only with peculiar A stars, it's things like europium and strontium and things like that, or things that have nothing to do with anything going on in the interior, but the magnetic field is present and causes strange elements to be present at the surface in high abundances. Well, here, I just want to point out that the lines, the individual components due to the splittings that I was just illustrating are sharp at this field strength. And this is because the star broadening that normally takes place, the mixing of the levels are being interfered with by the fact that they have been spread out by a 10 to the 7th, this is actually 3 times 10 to the 7th Gauss field. And hence you have the breakdown of the normal Stark effect in a white dwarf atmosphere, which was an amusing discovery to me at the time. And the star has been known since for 2 decades and is one of the better studied ones. Well, I don't want to just show, I want a pattern to emerge from these examples that I'm showing. And the trend is, of course, toward higher field. This is a star which has a rotation period of 100 minutes and has an even stronger field than the previous one, factor of 3 stronger, and it's 50% of the rotation period or so. And again, Wickrama Singha has done most of the modeling of this using Winner's calculations of the behavior of the field up to 100 megagauss, which is about what you have for this example as the polar strength, and it varies around the phase of the rotation. The first of these to be discovered was when Rudolf Minkowski was testing his Mount Wilson spectrograph in the 1938 for the Mount Wilson 100-inch. He took a spectrum of this 13th magnitude white dwarf, and this is old data. It had a feature at 4135, and for the next 3 decades, for nearly 4 decades, nobody understood what this feature was. But Angel Kemp and Angel and Landstreet discovered that it was both circularly and linearly polarized. And then when Rosner and Henry and O'Connell did the calculations of hydrogen in the regime where the quadratic effect could no longer be treated as a perturbation on the Coulomb potential, then when these curves were available, that it was seen that the star could be fitted as having a hydrogen atmosphere at 135 megagauss field or so. Now let me stop for a minute. Is there anything, if I'm using jargon that's not familiar to you, presume you'll stop me?
So for those that are rotating,
Uh-huh.
Is it the case that they all need offset dipoles?
They generally need, not all of them. All of the ones in binaries seem to, the AM-HRF systems. But it's true that you can get a good fit for a few of the isolated ones, but the offsets can be 35% from the center of the star, so that one pole is easily twice as strong as the other, and you can see that as they rotate, if they rotate. They don't all rotate. The star that I just showed you, which has been observed the longest here, it's this, didn't take it off of the screen, this has a non-varying spectrum for 3 decades. And so the lower limit to the rotation period has been estimated to be hundreds of years. It's got very strong features.
What's the longest detected spin period?
The longest?
Yes. For which there's a positive detection.
There may be one that's 2 weeks. The shortest is 12 minutes, which you may have heard of, because it's the closest thing to a millisecond pulsar.
Isolated
white dwarf. It's actually in a wide binary.
At 12 minutes.
12 minutes.
Let's see, the spectrum hasn't varied for 12 years. Is there a geometry where the star can rotate and the mag?
Yes. Yes, if you have a pole-on view with perfect axial symmetry, that can be the case.
That's
if you have an equator on view with perfect axial symmetry, if there's no offset between the pole of the magnetic field and the rotational pole, and there's perfect axial symmetry in the magnetic field, so it's possible. These are, however, the ones that do not rotate. There are many that haven't been observed well enough to tell whether they rotate or not, but for the ones that have been observed well enough, they all have two features in common. There's only 5 of them, actually. They're fairly cool, well, they're at least below 20,000 degrees temperature, which suggests at least several, given their masses, billion years or so is the cooling time. And secondly, they have very high fields. Now, it's possible that some without those characteristics will be shown to be non-rotating, but that's not yet known to be the case.
For systems that have
strong limits on a lack of rotations, such as many tens of years or 100 years, they are fairly cool and high field compared to the average.
With high fields that are rotating.
I showed you one that has a period of 100 minutes, which is nearly 100 megagauss. That's not one of the very highest fields. The one that has the period of 12 minutes is a high field. We'll get to that.
So the main evidence for offset dipole is that you get modulations due to rotation. You see differences in polarization and in pulse.
Yes. In spectral polarimetry, in particular, you can do the best modeling.
And what is the range of offsets?
Up to as much as 35 or 40% from the center of the star is where you would place the center of the dipole. And in AM-HR, in interacting binaries, I think the same is true. I don't know exactly the highest case, but you have poles that have very different field strengths. Usually the weaker pole is the one facing most closely in the direction of the secondary star, and it's accreting in an AM-HR system to the weaker pole. So I think that's always the case,
can you also
as far as I know.
Like if they're synchronously rotating those systems, I don't know if they are or not, but if they were, could you also distinguish cases where the axis of symmetry of the dipole is tilted with respect to the axis of symmetry, like to the rotation axis? So as well as an offset to also...
Yes, you need both.
You do need both.
Yes. You start with the assumption of the offset in angle from the rotation axis, and then you see whether, if the field on both sides are of the same strength, you don't need to offset further from the center of the star.
So
both sides in just direction.
Sorry,
Yeah.
The rapidly rotating magnetic white dwarfs, the lone white dwarfs, the young, are they hot?
The one that has this very short period is pretty hot, but not all of them are hot. The PG-1015 object, 100 megagauss, 100-minute period, that's about 15,000 degrees Kelvin. Although it's not known whether it's massive, so I can't tell you whether the cooling age is exactly what that would be.
And also in the rotating lone white dwarfs, do you need something more complex than an offset dipole to field? Is there evidence for anything more?
Yes. In the case of at least two, the best, it may be that a quadrupole will be an adequate representation, but the way you can often model it with a simple dipole of low field and a spot which in some way, well, it's a spot that is of much higher field, which rotates around the limb of the star and might be not visible for half of the rotational period. So let's see if I have an example of that. I'll show in a minute. I've lost my place here. This star, GD229, was a mystery for a few decades longer than the Greenwich star that Minkowski first, and Angel et al., first detected polarization from, because the features didn't fit. They were extremely strong. They were stronger than they are in the hydrogen cases, but the features didn't fit the predictions for hydrogen. The simple solution is that it's actually due to helium, and this is a paper that I'm a co-author on with Gary Schmidt as the lead author. Very, very strong features like these didn't fit hydrogen at all. But finally, helium calculations were completed by a German group in Tübingen and Heidelberg. Schmelcher is the guy, and Heidelberg is still working on this quite actively. And you can see calculations for 200 to 1,000 megagauss for helium. The field here is mean is about 300 megagauss, and there's no evidence of hydrogen in the atmosphere, but the fit to helium is quite nice. So this was the first high field helium white dwarf, helium atmosphere white dwarf to be discovered. It also has a parallax suggesting a high mass. Well, I want to show you the one I've been working on in my off time while visiting here. Now, this is a cool white dwarf plotted on an F lambda scale, which makes, I use this for brown dwarfs because anything that's even warm looks very blue on this scale. So the fact that this turns way over is just the opacity that you see in late type stars around 4,000 angstroms, the so-called 4,000 angstrom break, amplified in a cool white dwarf that has apparently accreted from the interstellar medium or from a circumstellar cloud. And these are rare, but these are called DZ white dwarfs. And in addition, this one, as you can see, is magnetic. This is the first time I've seen a DZ magnetic out of the 60-some now known. This is also, it was found independently by us kind of accidentally 2 years ago when we were observing brown dwarfs, and this was a backup target for just reasons that didn't have a spectral class. And Neil Reed is my collaborator on this project. You can see the nice triplet of sodium. It's a low field. It's just over 2 megagauss. The fact that the sodium doublet, the well-known 5892 angstrom D lines, are spaced close together because of the spin orbit splitting is small enough not to be resolved in zero field at this resolution. So it breaks into a nice triplet as a result, even though it's a doublet. It breaks into a Zeeman triplet of delta M's minus 1, 0, and plus 1. The calcium 2 is in a murkier part of the spectrum where all this opacity has come on and blended things together. This is calcium 1. This will be interesting to do some detailed analysis on. This is the subordinate triplet of magnesium, which is a strong feature in G and K type stars, strong in the sun, but it normally at rest has a triplet centered around 5175 angstroms. For reasons I haven't yet digested, it splits into four principal components in the presence of this field. It's got to be a more complicated story than the sodium, but it's something I'm working on.
Does this have hydrogen on it?
There's no hydrogen. But then, this is where H-alpha would be, and it would make a nice triplet at this field. But most of these diseases are helium-rich, as you know. And nobody understands where the metals really come from. Charles Alcock still thinks they are swallowing up comets right and left, as far as I know. Here's a sort of detail of the magnesium and sodium I should have put up to show you this a little bit more clearly.
What's roughly the T-factor for this?
Oh, it's about 5,500, 6,000 degrees. It's very close to solar temperature.
It's a radiative acceleration. It's tough or impossible.
It's certainly not going to be due to the interior. It's right. It's got to have accreted from somewhere or something fallen onto it. And the convective envelope will be quite deep. It's easier to explain metals in a hydrogen-rich atmosphere because the convection zone at this temperature would be much shallower. Okay, I want to talk about how these properties relate to binary star evolution and show yet other examples where we now see a magnetic white dwarf in some sense in a binary. This is fairly subtle. This is one of the sources discovered with the All Sky Survey of the Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer by this work is by Stefan Van et al. Can you see the H beta profile, and does it look peculiar to you? It's got a couple of wings to it, to the normal H beta line. And the answer turns out to be almost certainly that this is a composite spectrum of two stars, an ordinary DA modeled with this curve labeled A, and a magnetic DA labeled B, where there's a small quadratic shift to the center, magnetic DA labeled B. Well, you get into this game, it starts out as botany and it becomes hopefully physics at some point. But I think this is a fairly subtle superposition of an ordinary DA and a magnetic DA. But it gets better. You can after you subtract it out, the model that fits the DA, so that you leave a triplet in the spectrum, you can see that that model has a high log G. This is indicative of about 7 or 8, this is at least 8/10 of a solar mass, and then what is left is at the same distance, and although this estimate is certainly coarser, there's no doubt that, for example, these two stars added together would exceed the mass of the Chandrasekhar limit if they merged. But nothing is known about their separation other than they appear unresolved on the sky and present a composite spectrum. And so, unlike the stars that Tom Marsh has worked on, that Bergeron and I discovered as the low mass shoulder, those all turn out to be binary. Those all would probably not add up to the Chandrasekhar limit because the secondary, the visible component, if there's only one component seen, is of low mass by selection. But these, the ones involving magnetic white dwarfs, in at least two strong cases, were not.
Question: how wide a binary white dwarf can you detect from the Doppler?
Yes, you can if you have very careful observations of H alpha, and if the star isn't too hot. These are probably too hot. You need to have a temperature below about 20,000 degrees, maybe a little higher, where the formation of hydrogen alpha in the atmosphere begins at such a high level that there's a non-LTE layering of lower temperature gas, which makes for a sharp core. And that sharp core has about a width of 50 kilometers per second, can be used for that purpose. Pardon?
I see what you're saying is the pressure working on these lines inhibits radial velocity protection.
This is the magnetic star is 40,000 degrees. That's too hot for the non-LTE core to form.
I guess in practice, what is the largest binary period that has been measured?
The largest?
Yes.
That's
what the measurement.
The largest.
I mean, presumably it becomes easier the closer the two stars are.
Right. There's been almost no... Oh, the largest... Okay, so we go back to the Marsh sample. Really hasn't been done for any of these magnetics, I'm sorry to say. For the Marsh sample, it's of order several days. For the one that we discovered in 1988, it was 3 days. So they would... And they have low masses. So the Landau-Lifshitz formula tells you that it will be many universes, lifetimes, before gravitational radiation gets to merge them, because you don't have anything else to work with two white dwarfs except gravitational radiation. You'd love to have magnetic breaking, but even in a case like this, the magnetic breaking will be negligible because even though the field is very strong, it falls off as r to the minus 3, and the stars are too many radii apart. Although we don't know, as I stress, the separation for this particular case. But if you took a magnetic double like this, put it in at such a separation, it would still be a long time to merger. Let me show you a less subtle one, although it was harder to understand at first. This is a higher field version of the same thing, to cut to the quick, where this was the spectrum that we first observed. And if you just had the blue part of the spectrum, which is normally what we work with, it just looked peculiar. It looked like the normal Balmer lines with peculiar shoulders or something. But once you got out into the red part of the spectrum, you found this thing at wavelengths nowhere near where hydrogen features occur at rest in a non-magnetic DA. Then you saw that you needed to do more. And the answer, again, is subtract out an ordinary DA, which turns out to have a mass of about 9/10. And the relative magnitudes, again, tell you that the magnetic has a high mass of about 9/10. Combined mass, if they merged above the Chandrasekhar limit, this is the spectrum of what is left after you subtract the model of the ordinary DA. And it's one of these things that looks like that GD229 star, although the features aren't at the same place. The star that didn't fit hydrogen, that had a field of 300 megagauss, and that is in fact what you wind up having. Here is the star, the B component, the magnetic component of LB11146 versus GD229, and both are explainable with atmospheres of helium. The companion, LB11146A, if you don't mind all this nomenclature, ordinary DA, has a hydrogen atmosphere. This one, magnetic object, is a magnetic DB. And their separation is unknown, but we were foolish enough to write a proposal to observe it with the Hubble Space Telescope to see if the two could be resolved. If the Hubble showed that they could be resolved, the result to me would have been uninteresting, as it would have shown they were many tens of AU apart. But the limit that we got for the fact that they are unresolved at HST resolution only says that they are separated by less than half of an AU, which again doesn't tell you whether they'll ever have time to come into contact or not. If they do, they would exceed the Chandrasekhar limit if there isn't a lot of mass loss from the circumstellar disk that results from the merger.
Is there a simple explanation for why the composition should correlate with the magnetic field spectrum?
No. There is no great difference in the distribution of compositions in the atmosphere for the 65 magnetic white dwarfs versus the ensemble of 1,000 and nearly 2,000 with spectral types for white dwarfs in general. There are many, most are DAs, some are DBs, There's one DZ. There are several of these DQs with carbon features. Those are easy to find, especially by techniques such as the Sloan survey, so there are going to be more of those showing up selectively. There's no, I'll get to some generalized plots of things like mass versus rotation and temperature in a few minutes.
Before you go on, while you're on these binaries, are there any DA, DZ binaries?
Yes.
So there, where the DZ has no hydrogen?
The DC has no features, no hydrogen.
Oh, DC, DZ.
Oh, DZ, DA, DZ. No, I don't know of any of those, but DZs are rare.
Anyway.
There's a magnetic DA that, it's a complicated argument. I'm not 100% certain it's correct, but there has to be an extra source of featureless light in the system, so it's probably a magnetic DA plus a DC of different temperature. There are many of these that turn out to be binary nonetheless, and I've saved, to me, this is the most interesting one in a way, but the separation is the least interesting. It has, again, a massive DA, ordinary DA companion, but it's many arc seconds away on the sky. So they are nothing but a common proper motion pair. But the primary, the primary star by mass anyway, has an estimated mass of very close to the Chandrasekhar limit just from analyzing the other star and assuming, and it's not 100% certain this is correct, that they are associated and therefore at the same distance. But if they are, and this is the one that's spinning with a period of 725 seconds, and it's got one of the highest fields known, it's got one of the largest dipole offsets known, and it varies its spectrum like crazy over 725 seconds. Again, the name of the reviewers here are at the top, but the people that did this work is a group in Leicester that analyzed Rosat sources and identified white dwarf counterparts to soft X-ray sources. Burley et al. The group is led by Martin Barstow in Leicester. And the offset here means that on the high field side, you can get a field as high as 800 megagauss on the strong pole side, which is getting up there. So let's continue the theme of masses. 10 years ago,
there's some quotable uncertainty on the mass estimate.
Of that one? Yeah, it's, first of all, it has to be assumed the two are likely to be associated in a common proper motion pairing, as many white dwarfs have separations like that, corresponding to separations of hundreds to, I don't know whether this is even 1,000 astronomical units, but that's common. We know that stars are moving through space together, and they have essentially infinite orbital periods at that separation. But we also need, as the models are fitting something near the Chandrasekhar limit, the pressures are becoming enormous, and the uncertainties in the model certainly increase. It's also assumed in the conversion radius as a function of mass and T that it's a carbon-oxygen core, and of course it's more likely an oxygen-neon-magnesium core. One wonders if that could have resulted, in this previous example, could have resulted from a merger of two white dwarfs, and then the third component would be the wide binary DA star, and this could have started out as a triple system, because otherwise, how does it have such a short rotational period compared to white dwarfs in general, never mind other magnetic white dwarfs, which have longer periods? But that's a speculation. Okay. I was starting to show stars here all have trigonometric parallaxes that are well determined and shown by the error bars. This one turns out to be, this is the one that we discovered was a three-day period, a double DA binary, non-magnetic, low mass. Both components are low mass. And you can see that, as expected, and this is why we were suspicious of it, It lies above the mean HR diagram position of white dwarfs with parallaxes. And I added together two different colors in Greenstein's system. This was 10 years ago, when it was first becoming apparent that the magnetic white dwarfs on the whole include a lot that are more massive than average, and therefore they tend to lie down here at the lower envelope. Here's the helium GD229. Here is the original Greenwich star. And here's a couple of others that are magnetic. This is a binary, this is a binary, this is a binary. They have nothing to do with magnetic, they are not magnetic binaries. So if you remember the mass distribution that I showed earlier of the sample of white dwarfs analyzed with Pierre Bergeron, had a peak at 6 tens. This is a small sample statistics because although there are 65 magnetic white dwarfs known, only a subset of them have a way to get the mass. If it's a low field, you can get it from the fitting the spectral lines and ignoring the possible interaction of the magnetic splitting with the Stark broadening, but only at fields of a few megagauss or less. If it has a companion, you analyze, even if the companion is in the composite spectrum of the combination of them, you can analyze the non-magnetic star, and then you have the relative magnitude between the two. So this is the subset with mass estimates. There is some indication that this normal peak is there. It's exactly 3-4 stars. Here's a one low mass case, which isn't very secure, I might add. This isn't a very good determination. But the ones that have the best analyses are all over here. And therefore, I think it's becoming fairly clear that the mean mass of magnetic white dwarfs is substantially higher than that normal peak mass of 6 tenths appropriate to the field population without magnetic fields, or just everything summed together with and without, since 90-some% of them are without.
And how good is the evidence that those more massive white dwarfs are the products of mergers?
Well, let me carry this just a bit further, because we're getting to the punchlines of the statistics of the sample. You can plot, and I'll get back to your question in just a minute, but you can plot, for example, the magnetic field strength against mass, and you don't see any clear trend, nor do you possibly expect a trend unless ohmic decay is more efficient than calculations by Fontaine, Van Horn, and others have shown to be. And the ohmic decay should take billions of years for the lower component, the lower order components, especially the dipole component that seems to be arguably dominant in virtually all of them. And so then there are high field cases, and you see this with temperature. There are high field cases down here. There are high field cases up here. There are, however, far fewer very hot stars with magnetic fields, and a suspicious excess of the formal percentage of stars below 10,000 degrees with magnetic fields is higher than for the sample from the Palomar Green survey that are hot. So if I
does that take into account the different lengths of time that's been lived?
No, it does not take into account that. Most of all, it does not take into account the selection effects, in that the cool white dwarfs are not found in a color and magnitude limited survey like the Palomar Green was for things, say, hotter than 10,000 degrees. But I'm suspicious of whether there is evolution in the magnetic field with temperature, but it's it's unclear at the present time.
The other suspicious thing is it just me, or does it look like they're avoiding the ZZ SETI strip?
There's no
10,000 to 12,000.
There's no ZZ SETI known to be magnetic. Phaish 7, the one that has the helium and hydrogen mixed atmospheric composition and a rotation period of 2 hours, is very close to the dB pulsation region, but it may be slightly cooler. There's no pulsating white dwarf that is magnetic. So that's an interesting point. after a few years of Sloan, maybe we'll know more. If we will have lots of stars like these. Okay, now I started to talk about the distribution of the magnetic field strength with mass, and now again we know the mass for far fewer than 65 of them. There's no clear trend at the moment.
Can I ask,
you don't expect one.
So the 0317 is clearly a young object because it's still hot.
Yes, this is the spinning one.
And then the other hot ones, you know the masses of those? You know, just by chance. So the age, I guess what I'd love to see is B versus age.
So that's a good. That's a.
I guess it's the same as temperature in some sense.
No, the magnetics, the massive ones cool at the very beginning faster, but for the bulk of the Mostel part of the curve, that is when they follow the simple Mostel law for quirky reasons, they are much slower. And then they become fast again when they crystallize at a relatively high temperature like 10,000 degrees. There's one massive ZZ Ceti, which should be the chance to observe pulsations for a star with an interior that is partially crystallized. The double degenerates are indicated here with DD. This is a wide double degenerate. These are unknown separations. Okay, what about the spin period distribution? I've just given you individual cases. I haven't told you about the trend as a whole. This is the distribution of rotation periods for the subset that have either measured rotation periods from polarimetry or good enough observations to say that it's very long, which is, I guess it's 7 out of this set. And this is the zero line. So there's some evidence that this distribution is truly bimodal. And it has therefore been suggested that, again, these are the ones that are in this group are also both fairly old as white dwarfs and have high fields. So they may have, the field may have in some sense spun the star down either in the evolution prior to the white dwarf state or due to its interaction with the interstellar medium during the white dwarf cooling phase. It has also been speculated that at least some of these could have resulted from mergers or from some kind of binary star evolution. Now, there are two orders of magnitude lower space density of AM HERS, according to the estimates, where you have mass transfer from a non-degenerate secondary onto a magnetic white dwarf whose magnetic field funnels the accretion into a polar spots near but not at the pole. I don't want to go into AM HERS. I think I'm already out of time. You know about the fascinating spectra probably of AM HERS. You can measure the Zeeman components when they go into low states, and Wickrama Singh has modeled these. You can measure cyclotron features, the thermal radiation from accretion in an AM HER coming out in the optical as cyclotron, coming out in the X-ray as brims, and coming out in a reprocessing component which is formed from both. Well, I don't want to go into that, but it is interesting to compare a few properties of the AM HERs. This is the magnetic field strength of the white dwarf primary versus the orbital period. And the period gap that is characteristic of CVs is not seen real clearly in this distribution. It should be between 120 some minutes and 180, 2 to 3 hours. Well, the sample size is small. The other thing that's a bit curious about it is, of course, as you go to low fields, the ability to synchronize the system can be lost due to the weakness of the field, and you may have a DQ Hercules or intermediate polar instead. Until recently, there were no known really high field ones, but now there are two known above 100 megagauss. So their field distribution is not quite the same as the isolated magnetics, but the difference may be due to selection effects. I have one mystery apparently isolated magnetic called GD356. It's the only isolated magnetic that shows Zeeman features in emission. And it's a rather simple pattern. This is H alpha, the pi component, the central component. The two sigmas on either side are better defined than it is for H beta. The spectrum here has been normalized, and there were attempts to model it in terms of a chromospheric type temperature reversal. Here's the circular dichroism in circular polarization. This is the H beta line down here. It's more complicated. Well, the field is several megagauss here, 13 megagauss. It's on the low side for the AM Hertz, but it's still in the AM Hertz range. Or maybe it was formerly a DQ Hertz. Or maybe it still is accreting, but at a very low rate, and that's what is producing the apparent temperature reversal and the H alpha emission. And the companion would then have to be, if you'll excuse me for getting in brown dwarfs, it would have to be, this is a T dwarf, this is Strauss et al.'s first discovered methane dwarf from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. However, Adam Burrows and I couldn't resist working on it, and this is from our paper, where we have the main point of this paper was to emphasize the dominant role of the alkali opacity. This is potassium 1 resonance doublet, like the sodium line I showed you earlier in the white dwarf split in a magnetic field. Well, here there's no magnetic field, it just dominates the red opacity from 0.6 microns practically to 1 micron. They are weaker alkalis and a weak molecular feature here. Well, the point being, you don't detect in careful infrared observations, you detect nothing, no indication of an excess, no indication of a companion. And this is already a cool white dwarf. This has got a temperature of about 5,000 degrees. And so I don't know what's going on here, but I still suspect accretion is occurring at a low rate. And this may be the observation of the end of the AM Hertz phenomenon or the DQ Hertz phenomenon. We have been trying to detect variations in this object. It always seems to look roughly the same. I need a 10-meter telescope or something to really do the time-resolved observational problem correctly. We've looked for radio gyrosynchrotron, but the detection, no detection at the VLA was possible. It's been observed with ROSAT, and there's no detection of a corona. Everything attempted on this has produced a null result. But let me close by just a few speculations about the origins of the magnetic fields in white dwarfs. There's two classes of ideas. Both have not been worked on very much in recent years. Most people, and it's argued in Wickrama Singh's review, that they're most likely primordial or fossil fields, and that the progenitors are magnetic A stars. That is nice in providing a progenitor that has a higher mean initial mass than the average for white dwarf progenitors is likely to be, and there's approximate agreement in the formation rate between the magnetic A stars on the main sequence and the fraction of white dwarfs forming that are magnetic. Moreover, there's one white dwarf that has been found in the Praesepe cluster, which is the kind of youngish cluster that it's old enough for some of the BP and AP stars to have evolved through white dwarf phase, since it's 650 or so million years old. However, I don't want to say very much about the second option, but it seems to me that it's still quite possible, and perhaps of more interest to possible links to the formation of neutron stars, that the magnetic field occurs in a more violent convective phase very late in the star's evolution, They aren't as violent as the formation of a neutron star, but for example, those that get the carbon burning would form an oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf, would certainly produce a massive white dwarf. And so this idea is, to me, attractive. This guy used to be my dean, so I should give him a plug, I guess. Gene Levy, he's gone on to Rice University as provost. But these are ideas that basically suggest that the field was generated by convection late in the evolution. The question is whether the field geometries would be so simple in the white dwarfs that result. And again, the higher order multiples are predicted to die out faster, but maybe not fast enough. So I will end with that.
So maybe I missed it, but what is the direct observational evidence that massive white dwarfs are the products of mercuries?
The bipolar distribution in rotation periods has been interpreted as supporting that.
But then you said that the long spin period white dwarfs are the ones that are highly magnetized and would spun down. So
it isn't very good evidence, is it? I mean, it's. You know, possibly the one when the period is 720 seconds, maybe something involving binary evolution has happened. I mean, you see in V471 Tauri, you have a white dwarf that's weakly magnetic, which is an X-ray variable, which it's in a binary system. So it's characteristic of some binaries, but that's a very close binary compared to this one.
Can you remind us what the relative distribution of spins is for magnetic and non-magnetic white?
Okay, I didn't say anything about non-magnetics, and we don't know that much. There, you have this H-alpha line that can be used in cooler DA stars where the core becomes very sharp, and the limit that can be put on it corresponds to tens of kilometers per second rotation speeds, or V sine I's. So that would correspond to a period limit of something like 20 minutes in the normal radius. So it's not very interesting. It's possible then that most white dwarfs rotate with a similar distribution. In the ZZ SETI stars, there are splittings observed in pulsating white dwarfs. Splitting have been observed, which are interpreted as splittings due to rotation. And again, the indicated periods range from hours to days.
So those are similar, in fact, to the magnetic white dwarfs. But I guess we could play the game, of course, dividing up the magnetic white dwarfs into, say, two logarithmic bins, those with the highest fields and those with the lowest fields, and then compare the distribution of spins.
Of spin periods.
Would there be any significant difference?
I guess they didn't do that in there. Well, would there be a significant difference? Let's see. Apparently, they didn't plot that in the review. The one with the very short spin period is one of the highest magnetic fields. The two shortest periods, I think, are 100. I think after 12 minutes, you jump to 100 minutes. There may be one at 80 minutes. There are strong fields in those cases.
Now, is it true that one of the short period is the 12-minute magnetic rotator was originally thought to have very long spin period? Are there examples of white dwarfs with very long spins, which in fact has turned out not to?
Turned out to be short?
Yeah.
It's possible that some are masquerading and that the observational data haven't been sampled correctly. That is, you need to detect a 5-minute period. It's very hard because if you're looking for spectral variations, you would have to repeat many, many cycles of observation to build up the signal to noise, especially with a polarimeter, with polarimetry optics in there. Your signal to noise is degraded. And so it's possible that the answer to your question is yes, that we just have missed some short period ones.
I guess, but my question was more pragmatic. Has there been any example of one which was originally classified as being 20th century rotators, but then
no.
turned out to have a measurable?
No, the century rotators were so unexpected and bizarre that people keep looking at them and seeing whether there's a change in the spectrum. And of course, the CCDs have come along since the discovery of Greenwich 470 and GD229, the two perhaps best observed cases, and now the data are better. But there really still aren't that many people in the world doing these kinds of observations, and so I wonder if that will continue to be the case. I'm glad one of them is Gary Schmidt.
I have a question about the multipole structure of the magnetic field. In the A stars, if there are other progenitors, do we have any information regarding, is the field messy on an A star in the way that the field is messy to the sun, or is it clean?
That's, again, a field that was very active about 40 years ago. I remember people talking about beta core corona borealis and stars that had spots and silicon and europium and things like that. They also were more complicated than dipoles. But Occam's razor, you try to do the simplest thing that almost fits that you can. So all sorts of details are no doubt missed.
So what's the Kurtz study, for example, that are the pulsators?
Mm-hmm.
Or mostly all offset dipoles?
Pulsating
magnetic A-star.
Yeah. Offset dipoles.
Offset dipoles.
Which, in some sense, is equivalent to a quadrupole.
Yeah, well, it's a special combination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the magnetic field of the white dwarf is primordially formed by some kind of flux freezing or something, then presumably if there are large non-dipolar components, you will be sensitive to those because your polarimetry is a transfer effect. And although the high-order multipoles die off very fast with radius, the light rays that come to you have to pass through the high-order multipoles when they're near the surface. Would that be a true statement?
I'm more aware of complications in the interpretation of magnetic white dwarf primaries in AMHERS. For example, EF Eridani has clearer quadrupole structure than I'm aware of in the isolateds. But the methods of analysis are different. I mean, in EF Eridani, you have accretion going to multiple poles, and you follow the accreted material through the broad emission line behavior. So you have different information to tell you answers. Only when it goes into a low state do you observe its photosphere. So I don't really know the answer. I suspect that the analyses are oversimplified and that the geometry could be more complicated than an offset dipole. But it's a simple tool to use. And then the idea of a dipole plus spot is also equivalent to, it can be modeled in terms of a quadrupole,
sure.
In my recollection.
Well, an offset dipole. Mm-hmm.
An offset dipole one way and then other.
Okay, great. Well, Jim's here for...
Tomorrow until the afternoon.
Great.
Okay. And we are having a discussion.
I came up with having maybe a brief chat tomorrow morning, since most of us are more interested in neutron stars and white dwarfs, just a comparison of magnetism and white dwarfs and neutron stars, since there's some interesting parallels and some interesting significant differences.
So where and when?
About 10 a.m. and either the Founders Room, if that's available or not, at in the main key room.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Well, thanks.